Hey guys, welcome back. This is Spiritual Storytelling, where we analyze stories and try to listen to the deeper wisdom they can provide when we're healing from trauma and addiction. If you find part of yourself in these stories today, set aside any judgment or shame that may arise. Try to investigate with gentleness and compassion and know that you're not alone. Welcome to part two of episode three, The Lady of Shalott. Breaking the curse of emotional unavailability and embracing the divine feminine. If you haven't listened to part one, I would recommend going ahead and checking that out. There's a ton of historical context that can really help as we wade our way through this. So, returning to Tennyson's Idylls of the King, we come to know both the lady and Lancelot a bit better. As I mentioned before, the storyline differs when we move from Tennyson's poem to his story, but you can still see the connective tissue. In Idylls, there's no mirror or curse. There's just a chance meeting. There's an intense, albeit one-sided, passion, and a beautiful woman that ultimately dies from her lovesickness, asking that her body be ornamented with all the trappings of royalty as she floats on a boat down to the palace to be confronted one final time by Lancelot. This is a long story, so I'm going to summarize the parts that are relevant to our discussion here today, but I highly encourage you to read it on your own because there are so many different readings that we can get from this story, and there are so many different aspects and elements of it that can be helpful. So if you have the time or interest, definitely check it out. Our story begins with a lie to Arthur. Lancelot tells him that he cannot attend a joust due to an old wound. In reality, he really wants to stay because Guinevere is sick and he wants to be by her side. But once Arthur is gone and he and she are alone together, she encourages Lancelot to go to the joust. She's worried that they are going to arouse Arthur's suspicions. Since he's already lied to the king, they're gonna have to come up with a pretty good story to justify this lie. He can't just show up to the joust after he told the king that his wound hurt him too bad to be able to do it. So the story they come up with is that if Lancelot jousts anonymously, he can still win. But he'll tell Arthur that he heard a rumor that his name alone intimidated men so much that he wins merely on his reputation. So, to make it justifiable, he lied in order to do the honorable thing, disguise himself as a nobody to win on talent alone. So, that's what they come up with, and he's going to stick to it. When he leaves to go to this joust, he pretty quickly finds himself lost, and also realizes that he has brought his shield, which is highly recognizable because of its ornate designs. So when he comes upon this old manor, he's excited. He asks both for directions and a blank shield so that no one will recognize him. This is where he first meets Elaine, or the Lily Maiden. When seeing him face to face, Elaine looks at him with intense and knowing eyes. It's said that she can read the cloudy thoughts on his face as they occur to him and will do whatever she can to cheer him up. Once alone together, she looks at him openly, and we're told that he's struck with a quote, sort of sacred fear. Lancelot then leaves to go attend the joust and, of course, wins the tournament. But he's also seriously wounded when a lance pierces his side. He leaves in a hurry, maintaining his anonymity with Elaine's brother, who then takes him to a secret place and begins to treat his wounds. At this point, Arthur is perplexed as to why this man who moved eerily like Lancelot would leave immediately without claiming either his prize or glory, and he then sends Gawain to seek out this man. As he searches, Gawain comes back to the home of the Lily Maiden, who also longs to know what happened to her knight. Interestingly, before Gawain can tell Elaine, sorry, that's a mouthful, before he can tell her where Lancelot was wounded, he merely tells her that he's been injured. Elaine immediately grabs her side and faints. in this way, she can literally feel Lancelot's pain. But Gawain is taken by her beauty, and he's described as handsome in his own right. In terms of status, he would have made a remarkably good match for her. And it's said that she enjoys his company too. She thinks he's sweet and gallant. But ultimately, she rebuffs him because she cannot let go of her love for Lancelot, even though she has been told multiple times that he's in love with someone else. The narrator remarks here, "And so she lives in fantasy." Ultimately, Elaine decides to show Gawain the shield that she still holds, who then immediately realizes the mysterious knight's true identity. He then entrusts the rest of his mission to her, believing that she knows where Lancelot is, and returns to Arthur, which, just if you're curious, is really not happy with him doing that. Elaine seeks Lancelot out, and eventually finds him, ghastly pale and malnourished as her brother struggles to nurse him back to health. She stays by his side, tending him patiently and unfailingly, as it takes him quite some time to heal. It's also said that Lancelot at this point, due to the pain and the fever, is less than courteous, can you imagine? And then later suggests that in his feverish state, gets rather close to Elaine. The language is really flowery and kind of obscure, so I can't tell exactly what kind of vows he's making to her, but it's definitely suggested that there is a closeness building that, once well, Lancelot is not willing to act on. Eventually, though, he's well enough for them to return to her home. He gets back and readies himself to leave to go back to Arthur and Guinevere. And as he's preparing for his journey, he comes to her and asks her what she would have of him in return for caring for him so diligently. She asks to be married. Of course, Lancelot denies her outright, saying that he will never be a married man. When he denies her, she then asks if she can't be his wife, could she at least follow him through the world, loving him and being, quote, as a servant to him. This too he denies, telling her that she's really young and that in time she'll find another that she can love more fully. He also tells her that pretty much what he had in mind was, you know, she could marry some like poor guy, and then Lancelot would give them like a big nice house on his land and make them rich, and, you know, they could be happy. And at this point, you know, she's not interested in his money or his land. She disagrees that this is just a youthful flame. She persists in her passionate love for him. Seeing the hurt that this is causing to his daughter, Elaine's father pulls Lancelot aside and begs him to resort to harshness to break her of this love and devotion for him. Lancelot decides that this is a good idea and leaves without saying anything else to her, returning to Arthur and Guinevere. First of all, this is extremely discourteous in terms of chivalry and social protocol, but also it's just kind of mean. Like, not only do you know that this young girl is madly in love with you, but she did just like nurse you back to health while you kind of acted like a jerk. So to leave without saying a word was really a slap in the face. Understandably, Elaine is bereft and bedstricken with heartbreak, but she doesn't seem to get better. She composes the song of Love and Death, where she muses that when love is sweet, death is bitter, but when love is bitter, death is sweet. She begins chanting to herself, love or death, which here we can even see traces of the Lady of Shalott. Remember, just before she sees Lancelot and is compelled from her place at the loom, she first sees a funeral, and then two lovers. Elaine tells her family that she will die. They don't want to believe her. They still feel like she's perhaps taking this all a little too seriously, and that in time, she will heal. But regardless, she gives her brother instructions for what to do with her body once she's dead. She first dictates a letter, which he copies down to be placed in her hand. She then instructs him to decorate her bed with all the finery of a queen and place it on a boat on the river, to carry her body to the palace, where she can have her final word to Lancelot and Guinevere. Of course, she does indeed die, and her wishes are carried out. The royalty is struck with pity for her, especially upon hearing her final letter read aloud, where she describes how her love was doomed. They bury her extravagantly and inscribe her tomb with words of beauty and pity. So first, I want to work through a few of the connections that I see between the poem and the story. In part one, we touched on the divine feminine and the creative and empathetic abilities of our Lily Maiden. Here, they definitely get fleshed out for us to see a little more clearly. So, Elaine can see into Lancelot in a way that other people can't. She can read his emotions on his face. When he's wounded, she is able to literally feel his pain before she even knows where or how he is wounded. She has this great power and potential to connect to these unseen elements in him. And this is a power that will ultimately take her over. It gives her a false sense of knowing and closeness, when in reality, she can't see the most obvious thing about him that's clear to everyone else. He is completely in love with Guinevere. We see, too, a connection with fantasy, a reality building that was reflected to us in the Lady of Shalott's mirror. The refrain, "And so she lived in fantasy," is one that comes back to haunt her narrative as it unfolds. We don't hear it just once. And moving into the story itself, what about the sacred fear? Those are very specific words. This, to me, anyways, sounds remarkably like a deep-rooted fear of intimacy. Someone broke that word down for me once, intimacy, I mean, as into me see, or see into me. The sacred fear that Lancelot experiences is just that, the fear of being seen, the fear of being unwrapped and known. And that is precisely what keeps him attached to Guinevere. If he were to open himself up to someone that was actually available to him, he might risk being seen in a real way. And that brings me to notice that neither party is interested in a relationship that they can actually have. Lancelot cannot choose Elaine any more than she can choose Gawain. And then when she confronts Lancelot with her love and asks him to make her his wife, he refuses. So what does she do? She responds by asking him to let her follow him through the world, to let her love him and be, quote, as a servant to him. So just as Elaine would rather be Lancelot's servant than Gawain's wife, Lancelot would rather be Guinevere's shameful lover rather than Elaine's husband. Ultimately, neither are looking to connect in a meaningful way. Neither want the work that comes with building love, the vulnerability, the intimacy that it takes to build it brick by brick. They are each interested only in the world of fantasy that they have created around the one they desire. And this is where compromising can become unhealthy. If they can't have what they want, what they're worth, they will take what they can get. They are willing to set aside the things that mean the most to them. Elaine gives her life, and Lancelot sacrifices his honor to accept whatever meager thing is offered. This is a really common theme in unhealthy attachments. When we're emotionally unavailable, we build on a foundation that's there, no matter if they're solid or not. So we start a relationship not caring if we're ready to do the work that it takes to actually build a healthy one. We take a sort of sick pride in what we're willing to give up for love, and we tend to expect it in return. Is anyone else having flashbacks to the bridge here? We make the object of our fantasy the one and are willing to lower our expectations to take what we can get, hoping that one day our sacrificial love will transform our unavailable partner into an available one. We hear variations of this all the time. We hear things like, if I can just show him that I really care, or if I can just prove to her that she is loved, maybe he or she or they can be healed. Maybe they will change for me. This is the lie of self-sacrifice. Try as we might, and believe me, I have several times to the point of absolute absurdity. We cannot love someone into wholeness. We cannot give love hoping that it will result in us receiving it. Because when we stay in this fantasy, we are not actually in love or being loved. We are caught in a reflection, in a dream, and it is so beautiful, but we do not see the other as they are, nor do we let ourselves be seen as we are. And so we come to Elaine's song of love and death. If we are addicted to relationships or falling in love, or we have issues with intimacy, we must have what we desire or nothing at all. We are either made whole by the returned affections of another, or made empty and meaningless by the lack of them. We are so desperately hungry for intimacy, to be known by another. Really and truly, to be seen and accepted, that we are willing to do anything to get it. But this desperation is precisely what works against us. When we learn that to be seen, to be loved by another, is not what gives us meaning, is not what determines our worth, is not what defines us as people, we learn that we can indeed live without it. In fact, we can thrive. Finally, we can weave our webs with clear eyes, maintaining a connection with both ourself and the world that much more clearly resembles what actually is. If you liked what you heard today, let me know wherever you're listening. Comment, subscribe, or share. Literally every time I get a new follower or like, it makes my whole day. This is really like personal work for me to do, and it is just so gratifying to see that other people can enjoy it or relate to it in any way. And as always, if you're curious about me or my journey, check out craftingwholeness.com. This is a place where I work through my healing and some of the lessons I've learned along the way. Finally, with deep love and gratitude, I want to thank you for tuning in to Spiritual Storytelling.